British people. We are so powerless today, our country, our parliament, our democracy, slowly disappearing before our very eyes. But it shouldn't come as no surprise that this was planned in detail, in advance, by evil people who we thought we had defeated in two world wars. Now, the European Union was created not by someone standing up in an election saying, vote for me and I will create a European Union where your country will be province within it. No, of course not. But they all know that that would never have been achieved. So it had to be created secretly. It had to be created beyond the reach of you, beyond the reach of your representatives, beyond the reach also of your parliament. And the method chosen was treaty law. Treaties between countries. And international treaty law has an existence of its own independently of our parliament. You probably don't recall, but when Maastricht was being debated in parliament in the early 1990s, Douglas Hurd, who along with Francis Maude had signed the Maastricht Treaty, said that no matter what you say here, as he said to his fellow MPs, you cannot overturn the Maastricht Treaty. That was absolutely true. But that Maastricht Treaty and all the other treaties of the European Union affected not the relations between Britain and other countries, but affected the very constitution of the United Kingdom, its people, its parliament, and its democracy, and of course the people of parliaments and democracies of the other nations of Europe. Not long ago, a German parliamentary study came to the conclusion that we've come to ourselves, that is, that 80% of the laws applied to Germany were now made by the Brussels bureaucracy beyond the control of German parliament. And when it came to the Lisbon Treaty, you will remember, that the previous treaty had been roundly defeated in votes, particularly in France and Holland. So they decided to produce a different, slightly different treaty, but not allow anyone to vote on it. And 95% of the member states of the European Union did not hold a vote on the Lisbon Treaty. So it's no wonder that, according to the Eurobarometer tests of public opinion, only 50% of the people of the European Union now support the European Union at all. Now, 50%, we would think that's pretty high. But given the almost total support that there was for the European Union on the continent of Europe not many decades ago, that is quite a turnaround. This Lisbon Treaty was not only evil in the way in which they brought it into being, behind the backs of the people, after the people had rejected it previously, but it established a new legal country to which EU member states are subservient. It made future constitutional change possible, even without consulting us. That's sort of Paul Henry Spaak. Spaak joined, he was a Belgian, he joined the Belgian national government in 1936 as foreign minister, and with a man called Henri de Man, developed the Belgian National Socialist Party. One of its notable acts was to refuse assistance to the legal Spanish Republican government, then locked in civil war with Franco's fascists. In 1938, Spaak said, "Some people wish to lead us into a policy of solidarity with the democracies against the fascist states. I refuse to stick to such a policy." He concluded, "If Great Britain and France want to help Czechoslovakia by invading Germany through Belgium, they will be treated as invaders." Mm-hmm. In fact, as the memoirs of Sir Alexander Gadogan, the pre-war British cabinet minister, note, that is exactly how the British forces seeking to defend Belgium against the Nazis were treated. Paul Henry Spaak became one of the EU's founding fathers and Secretary General of NATO. Mm. Couldn't make it up, could you? Walter Funk. Funk joined the Nazi Party in 1931 and promptly became not only Hitler's personal economic advisor, he was also Reich press chief, very influential position, under Goebbels at the propaganda ministry. He was the liaison man of the Nazi Party and the large industrialists, from whom he obtained financial and political support on Hitler's behalf. He signed a decree in December 1938 that provided for all Jewish enterprises to be sold or liquidated. Jews could be ordered to sell and were prohibited from acquiring any real estate. Jews were forced from this decree of Funk's to deposit all stocks, mining shares, bonds and other securities, specially designated banks, and accounts to be marked Jewish. Funk was convicted at the Nuremberg trials. On his release in 1957, he was employed, wait for it, by the Lower Saxon Education Ministry, where he helped to propagate the new European economic community to German schools and universities. So although Funk died in 1960, his blueprint for the European economic community, drawn up in Berlin in 1941, is virtually, as I point out in my books, virtually indistinguishable from the structure of today's European Union. Hans-Josef Globke. Dr. Adenauer, Germany's post-war chancellor, appointed Globke as a state secretary, that is, director of the chancellor's office in Berlin. This is after the war. Globke was the man who had drafted the Nuremberg race laws. And it was on Globke's advice that Adenauer made his senior appointments after the war. Globke helped to formulate the emergency legislation that gave Hitler unlimited dictatorial power in 1933. After the war, Globke became director, as I said, of the Federal Chancellery, and between 1953 and 1963, he was engaged with Adenauer on the foundation of the European Union. Let's take now a British lady called Lady Diana Moseley. Like several aristocratic families, and like so many politicians of all parties during the 1930s, Lady Moseley was charmed by fascism. Like Lloyd George, the liberal, you remember, she admired Hitler. Like the liberal Lord Lothian or the socialist Ardinal Toynbee, she would certainly have joined a Nazi-based government in Britain. Like Labour's Lord Allen of Hertford, she would have argued for more African colonies for the German Reich. And like the Conservative Sir Samuel Hoare, she would have tried to get rid of Churchill in order to prevent war. So just to say, we're not just talking about these people. It was common, you know, among lots of leading Tories, Labour Party and Liberals, MPs, politicians in the 1930s that they were not, shall we say, convinced opponents of Nazism, that's to put it mildly. And of course, her husband, Oswald Mosley, founded a fascist newspaper called The European. And the interesting thing is that Lady Diana Mosley died not too long ago, and just before she died, she did an interview with the BBC. Strange, you would think. You know, the BBC is always shouting at the rest of us that we're all fascists, isn't it? Mm. And then they interview the prime one, Lady Diana Mosley. And in that interview, Lady Diana Mosley gave her unstinting support to what? The European Union. Strange, isn't it, that the BBC should so recently interview a lifelong fascist? But perhaps not when we consider what happened in the 1930s. Because between 1937 and 1939, Winston Churchill was kept off the air by the BBC. To such an extent that obviously he had no real way. He wrote articles, of course, he did his research, but he could only broadcast if he went to a thing called Radio Normandy outside the country, which was set up by a British patriot called Captain Leonard Plug, funny name for a radio. And anyway, so that shows you that the BBC has fallen in this area. Now, I'd like to talk about Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, because this is where we get associations with the Bilderberg Group, of which I'm sure you have read. I've got a couple of chapters in two of the books on them. One of the great things that's happened recently, or in the last few years, is that, of course, the president of the Bilderberg Group ended up in jail. You remember him? Conrad Black of the Daily Telegraph?
I asked that question the other day.
Wonderful, isn't it? And in fact, when I stood in the year 2000 for the leadership of the UK Independence Party, two journalists, Christopher Booker and Bill Jamieson of the Sunday Telegraph, together with a rather disreputable individual from the southwest, stole the UKIP mailing list and sent out a letter attacking me. And I was not the kind of person who should be leading the UK Independence Party. Why? Because of my exposure to the Bilderberg Group. And who was the employer of Mr. Booker and Mr. Jamieson at the time? Mr. Conrad Black, the president of Bilderberg. Now, you won't hear that anywhere. I don't suppose any of you in UKIP have ever heard that story, have you?
No.
So you've got to be old like me to know what happened in the last 30 years of this kind of movement. Anyway, Prince Bernhard was co-founder of the Bilderberg Group in 1954. François Mitterrand, he was a leading member of the Vichy regime, the Nazi-friendly regime in southwest France. He was a member of the Vichy regime, but they actually received their highest award. And he becomes president of France and the great creator of the modern European Union. Then we have a man called Amato, Giuliani Amato, who's a former prime minister of Italy. Yeah, I'm sure you have not heard of him because there's been so many former prime ministers of Italy. And vice chairman of the European Union's Constitutional Convention, which we know produced this thing that this early version of the Lisbon Treaty, which was totally rejected by the French and Dutch in referenda. In the Italian newspaper Stampa in July 2000, this Amato said, "Sovereignty lost on a national level does not pass to any new individual. It is entrusted to a faceless entity, and those in command can neither be identified nor elected. As a matter of fact, the metamorphosis is already here. All we need are a few corrections here and there, along with a great deal of cunning. Their place will be taken by a multitude of authorities, each of which will be at the head of different interests." This is, of course, a classic element of fascism. And then he goes on, interests that possess ambiguous levels of power. Yeah, ambiguous levels of power. We see that all the time today, don't we? We elect local councillors to do something and we find they no longer do it. Then we elect another level and we find they no longer do what we thought they did. And then we elect our parliament and then we find they no longer do it either. It's the bureaucrat in Brussels. Ambiguous levels of power. How well he describes, in praise, what we know as an evil. By moving, the power we are used to will disappear. How true. In other words, the democratic power will disappear. Indeed, as we all know, it has disappeared. Amato continued in his article, In Europe, one needs to act as if what was wanted was little in order to obtain much. As if states were to remain sovereign to convince them to concede sovereignty. The Commission in Brussels, for example, should act as if it were a technical instrument in order to be able to be treated as a government, and so on by disguise and subterfuge. What a very good summary that is of the fascist European Union and what we see today. Now let's look at Kenneth Clark, the former Conservative Home Secretary and Chancellor of the Exchequer. I mean, he is, when you know something about a subject that Kenneth Clark is pronounced on, you know he's a buffoon. But most people don't know anything about the subject that he's been in charge of. He's been Home Secretary, he's been Secretary of State for Health, he's been Chancellor of the Exchequer. And in each one, he has been an absolute disaster. Oh, well, people are beginning to see it now when he's Lord Chancellor. You'd be surprised to know, perhaps, that it was Kenneth Clark, who was a young man, a young student at Cambridge University, who invited Oswald Mosley, the leader of the British Union of Fascists, to speak. And Michael Howard, the one who became leader of the Conservative Party, as a young student at the time in Cambridge, resigned from the Conservative Party in Cambridge because of this invite to Mosley. And, of course, actually everything that Clark believes in, he doesn't believe in the British Parliament. He once told Norman Lamont that he'd like to see the British Parliament become a local assembly. Yeah, he believes in collective corporate power. He believes in the end of the nation state. He believes in the euro, the abolition of the pound, the abolition of the... And there he is, occupying all these leading positions in the state. Unbelievable. So there's very little, distinguished between Oswald Mosley and Kenneth Clark, if you look at what he actually stands for, what he wants. All those things that Kenneth Clark wanted were well covered in Oswald Mosley's newspaper called The European. And, of course, it was Clark who pooh-poohed the idea and was the principal, power behind Cameron rejecting any referendum on the Lisbon Treaty. Although, you won't be surprised to know, that at the time he was rejecting our right to vote on the Lisbon Treaty, Clark was chairman of the Tory Party's Democracy Task Force. Well, to say that the European Union is a combination of modern corporatism and historic fascism may sound extraordinary, and it should be extraordinary, but it is not. But because the evidence is there, as clear as you could want to see it. But now I'd like you to listen to these quotes. You might like to think which of these quotations came from European leaders from the fascist 30s and 40s, and which from the heyday of the European Union in the 80s and 90s. Might is right in politics and war. Genocide is a natural phenomenon. It is recommended, even commanded, by the Almighty. Many Jews survive today thanks to the circumstance that they were forced labourers. Germans are tired of philo-Semitic overcompensation of the media and sterile grief rituals by politicians. The Jews should consider whether they would have behaved heroically if they had not been victims of the persecution. Germany should now, as it has become peaceful and reasonable, get all that Europe and the whole world has refused in two gigantic wars, a sort of smooth hegemony over Europe. Now, in fact, none of those were from the 30s and 40s. They were all from the 80s and 90s. In the following order, Helmut Kohl, Chancellor of Germany, Franjo Tuđman, President of Croatia, Lutz Niethammer, advisor to the German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder, Klaus von Dohnányi, the former mayor of Hamburg, and the final one was Joschka Fischer, the former German Foreign Secretary. So, this is the evidence. This is the evidence that cannot be denied. It is an evil beyond description. It's happened to us in our time, in our country. Now, most people don't know the detail of what I've told you, of course. But most people now, when I first started this, there wasn't a single newspaper, but this is in the late 80s, but not a single newspaper that was remotely even Eurosceptic, never mind anti. Now, most of the newspapers are quite strongly Eurosceptic. One of them actually promotes withdrawal. I think perhaps the Mail may join them in the medium term, because we're now seeing the horrendous economic and financial cost for people in Greece, Italy, Spain, Ireland, of the economic monstrous ideas of the European Union. Before, we could only point to the constitutional and democratic losses, that people understand economics rather better than they do constitutional. And so we are making progress through disaster, but it shouldn't have been necessary to make progress through disaster. So I'm going to end with something that we started in the year 1999, it was launched as a thing called the South Molton Declaration. Does anyone remember that? You might have heard the name. And in 2001, we turned it into a thing called the British Declaration of Independence. Now, the idea of this is to give people something that can actually make a difference, can actually get us out of this morass, as opposed to just asking that we should get out of it, or complaining that we're in. The idea was, and is, although the movement is, I'm afraid, dormant because of lack of funds, we wrote in 2001 at that general election to every single candidate of the three major parties. And we presented them with a declaration which said, you know, I, so-and-so candidate, if I'm elected to Parliament, will vote for a bill containing the following. And all those things were, you know, we have a democracy, a parliament, we make our own laws, and so on. Now, the point of this was a habeas corpus, trial by jury, and so on. Now, most people looking at, most MPs, most looking at it, said, well, sounds all right to me. But then, of course, they showed it to their party leaders. And this, we knew this would happen, you see. Because when you set out something that everyone thinks they agree with, and they're told by their party leaders they can't sign it, then even a thick MP might ask himself, we thought, what's wrong here? And we did it again at the 2005 election. But the interesting thing at the 2001 election was, having sent all these things out, all three major parties wrote to every single one of their candidates, warning them not to sign it. Unbelievable. The Liberal Democrats, so-called, wrote to their candidate saying it was so dangerous they shouldn't even read it. Unbelievable. Anyway, I've put it, I gave a little speech on this British Declaration of Independence, because whether it is that or something, it's something that does the same thing. This is the way we're going to get out. Because the idea of it was that those candidates of all parties who signed would be elected. And all those who didn't sign would have to stand up on the hustings and say, I reject that Britain is a country of parliament and a democracy. You see? That's what they had to admit to by not signing. But if the parties knew, if they could get enough of their 90% of their, 99% of their people through threat not to sign it at all, then people just couldn't believe what we were saying. They couldn't believe that they were rejecting a country of parliament and democracy. It's a matter of numbers. But in order to get those numbers, the people, the voters, had to be powerful. And as we all know, you know, when you get in this mess, we get into this mess because the voters aren't powerful. And it's a chicken and egg, but if we had the Daily Express on our side, if we had the Telegraph on our side, if we had the Daily Mail on our side, and if we had a couple of multimillionaires on our side, then I think still that could be an enormous way
exerting power directly at an election. Because at elections, that's the only time these people take any notice of us. Because they want to get back into Parliament. And if you make it an absolute precondition that they contribute, that they sign a document saying, I'm going to vote for this bill, then you've got a chance. And the other thing you do, of course, you, in the process, you get rid of all those who refuse to sign. Now, of course, some people are liars and cheats and they're trying to sign. But then, if they've got a track record of believing the opposite, not many people are going to believe them. That's what we would have tried to expose. But anyway, the British Declaration of Independence, or something like it, where the people at an election take advantage of their power at that point to change the constitution of Parliament. Sorry, I don't mean constitution in the sense of big C. I mean the people, the kind of people in Parliament. Because you can have as many referenda as you like, you can have as many demonstrations as you like, you can take as many legal cases as you like, constitutional cases. But until you get a majority in Parliament to pass a bill, then we're not going to get out of this morass. And this is the problem, and this is the opportunity. It's both a problem and an opportunity. That we've got to change the kind of people who sit in Parliament, and then you can put a bill forward. The idea was not to put a bill forward the day after the election. Of course, you might not have had a majority or anywhere near a majority. There's lots of MPs over the years. Bill Cash has been doing it for donkey's years, putting down bills that, you know, only he and a couple of men and a dog would vote for. It's silly putting down bills, no matter how good they are. And they have been good. They have been right. They have been morally correct. But there's no use giving your enemy succor by failing again and again. Mm. And the beauty of this was that we would gradually, over a period, know how many people had signed. And when you got a majority, then you would ask your sponsors to put the bill down, and then you'd have your majority. And you could do it secretly. I mean, people could sign and say, well, I'm signing, but I don't want it to come out until you've got a majority. Fair enough. You could have done that. Anyway, that's the idea. And if you want to know a little bit more about it, just go to our website, bdicampaign.org, or have a listen to the CD, which is on the table at the